Who is behind the establishment of the ISIS militants in Syria? How much influence does the U.S. government have today over those militants? What motivates Hillary Clinton to pursue warmongering policies abroad? Might we see genuine coordination between the U.S., Russia, and the Syrian army in the name of wiping out ISIS? Could the rise of Donald Trump in the United States presidential runoffs lead to the demise of the Republican Party and a fundamental shifting of the political landscape in America? On this week's Global Research News Hour, guest interviewer Colin Hamlin brings us a show devoted to some of the recent musings of prominent political researcher, historian, and commentator Webster Tarpley. On today's program, the U.S. elections, Syria, and the specter of international terrorism, a conversation with Webster Tarpley. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 8th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heart of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Since September 2014, the world dollar price of oil has collapsed. It has gone from levels of $103 a barrel down to close to $30 today. That's a collapse of 70% in demand for dollars for the world's largest commodity measured in dollars. In this political and financial context, the central banks of Russia and China are buying gold for their central bank reserves at a fever pace. Not only that, the People's Bank of China recently announced it has abandoned its peg to the U.S. dollar and diversify into a basket of currencies led by the euro. That comes from the article, Why Are Russia and China Buying Gold, Tons of It? By F. William Engdahl, posted April 6th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. No matter which name they go by, ISIS, ISIL, IS, or Daesh, the group has been deliberately engineered by the U.S. and Israel to achieve certain geopolitical goals. They are a religious, fundamentalist, Sunni terrorist organization created to terrorize and overthrow certain secular or Shiite Arab nations such as Syria and Iraq, but they are not just Islamic. They may be Muslims, and they may be advocating an Islamic state, but they are very much working towards the goals of Zionism. We have been inundated with propaganda surrounding the fraudulent war on terror, notably terms such as Islamic terrorism and radical Islam. But more accurate phrases would be Zio-Islamic terrorism and radical Zio-Islam. Secret military agencies such as the CIA and the Mossad pull the strings. That comes from the article, ISIS is a U.S.-Israeli creation. Top 10 Indications by Makia Freeman, posted April 7th, originally appearing at the Freedom Articles. The strangulation of Greece is a case in point for a successful experiment on how to rob Europe of its social and physical assets, putting the population into extreme poverty, too weak to even protest. A left-wing government in the most strategically located NATO country was an absolute no-go. No doubt, Tsipras himself, his family, and his government were criminally blackmailed into submission. Not obeying may lead to death. Just read up on Mohammad Mossadegh, Iran, assassinated by the CIA in 1953, Patrice Lumumba, Congo, Kinshasa, murdered by the CIA in 1961. Salvador Allende, Chile, murdered by the CIA in 1973. Saddam Hussein, Iraq, assassinated by the Bush-Blair murderers in 2006. Muammar Gaddafi, Libya, by NATO thugs in 2011, under orders of Hillary Clinton, then U.S. Secretary of State, today leading Democratic U.S. presidential contender, and the list goes on. That comes from the article, Europe, Are the EU and Euro on the Verge of Collapse? By Peter Koenig, posted April 7th. Until now, the U.S. aristocracy, according to the expression of Alexander Hamilton, was composed exclusively of WASPs, or white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. However, a first exception was made in 1961 with Irish Catholic John Kennedy, whose election enabled a peaceful resolution of the problem of racial segregation, and a second in 2008 with the Kenyan Barack Obama, which enabled the illusion of racial integration. In any case, in neither of these cases did the elected official use his power to renovate the governing class. Donald Trump, with his straight-talking attitude, incarnates a form of populism which is opposed to the conventional manners of the politically correct, so dear to the WASPs. The uneasy alliance between the president of the National Governors Association, the governor of Utah, Gary Herbert, and Donald Trump clearly demonstrates that an agreement between Trump and the ruling class will be very difficult to establish. That comes from the article, Who Will Be the Next President of the United States? By Thierry Meissan, posted April 6th, originally appearing at Voltaire Network. The entire California coastline lies along the Ring of Fire, which has become much more active in recent years. Scientists assure us that it is only a matter of time before the state experiences absolutely horrific natural disasters, but most Californians have been lulled into a false sense of security. In the end, I believe that the great shaking that will come to the state of California will be just part of the great shaking that is coming to the United States as a whole. This great shaking is something that I discuss in my new book entitled The Rapture Verdict, which is all about Bible prophecy and the last days. I am fully convinced that the judgment of God is coming to America and that everything that can be shaken will be shaken. That comes from the article, The Exodus of People Moving Away from California is Becoming an Avalanche, by Michael Snyder, posted April 7th, originally appearing at End of the American Dream. The Panama Papers tax haven leak is big. After all, the Prime Minister of Iceland resigned over the leak, and investigations are taking place worldwide over the leak. But the Panama Papers reporting mainly focuses on friends of Russia's Putin, Assad's Syria, and others disfavored by the West. Of course, Obama and Hillary Clinton enabled and supported Panama's ability to act as a tax evasion haven, so it's a little disingenuous for them now to say we should crack down on tax havens. That comes from the article, Panama Tax Haven Scandal, The Bigger Picture, by Washington's blog, posted April 6th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Colin Hamlin has been a longtime contributor to spoken word programs on radio station CKUW. This week, he brings us a special interview with prominent historian, author, and analyst Webster Tarpley. As you will hear, Tarpley's analysis acknowledges the phony nature of the war on terrorism. However, he does seem to regard the war on ISIS as legitimate and sincere, naming actors like Saudi Arabia and Turkey as culprits in aiding and abetting the militants. Here now is Colin Hamlin.
All right, welcome to this edition of the Global Research News Hour. I'm your host, Colin Hamlin, broadcasting out of Winnipeg, Canada. Our guest for today's show is Webster Griffin Tarpley. Dr. Tarpley is a Fulbright scholar and a doctor of history, and he's also the author of several books, including the popular unauthorized biographies of both George Bush and Barack Obama. He currently hosts a weekly radio program called World Crisis Radio and is involved in the Tax Wall Street Party based out of Washington, D.C. The topic for our discussion today will be the U.S. election, global politics, the Syrian war, amongst other things relevant to civilization-loving people. I wanted to interview Dr. Tarpley specifically for a number of reasons. Being well-versed in modern history, Tarpley brings a thoroughly empirical and historically grounded perspective on current events. And in my humble opinion, his commitment to historical truth is a good antidote for popular mythologies and impotent narratives that are unable to deviate from culturally sanctioned political correctness. So I'm sure it will be a lively discussion today. So I'm pleased to give you Dr. Webster Tarpley. Webster, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank you for your very kind words.
Could you give an example of a government in, let's say, the last 100 years that exemplifies for you what the proper and best role of government could be in terms of human development, peace, security, and human flourishing?
Like, yes, what... this would be the New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt here in the United States, starting in 1933. It reached a high point in terms of domestic reforms around 1936 or 1937, but the New Deal government then went on to pass the Lend-Lease law, which kept Great Britain, Soviet Union, and China in the war, prevented them from collapsing in all three cases, the U.S. production during 1941. And then this entire achievement, even after Roosevelt was no longer with us, it took the form of the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944, which was essentially a New Deal for the world, meaning that the economic reconstruction of the war-torn areas was facilitated, and it was the best world monetary system we have had before or since. Nothing since has come close in terms of actual economic development. And I say actual. You read figures on gross domestic product. Half the time, that's derivatives, speculation, various kinds of swindles. We've got to focus on tangible physical wealth, right? Hard commodities. Finance is not an industry. Steel is an industry, but finance is not an industry. So even the language has lost this distinction. So obviously the New Deal had flaws, right? Because there was a powerful internal opposition coming from the Wall Street banks, and there were also problems with the Southern Democrats who got themselves organized as of about 1937, a group of racist Bourbon Southern Democrats, as they're called here, began to counter-organize Roosevelt. But he was even when Dr. New Deal had to step aside and be replaced by Dr. Win the War, there was still plenty there to represent domestic reforms. I mean, the idea that an employer would give you healthcare benefits, that's something that comes out of the war experience here, when you couldn't raise wages because there were wage controls, but you could offer all these wonderful fringe benefits. That's how the American people learned what a fringe benefit was, because before that they hardly knew.
So just to kind of globalize this perspective now, one of the issues in the debate is, of course, the conflict in Syria. All the candidates have more or less a loosely defined position on it. Could you give your summary of what is really at stake there, and what are the real issues for someone concerned about what they hear in the news?
We also have to be worried about Europe, right? I was in Europe last autumn, in Italy and in Germany. Germany, in particular, people are extremely upset about the refugee flows, and of course, the refugee flows are a humanitarian catastrophe in anybody's book. We should probably start with the Iraq war, right, that Hillary Clinton voted for, and the essentially what is now called ISIS, or the Caliphate, or Daesh. This was a creation of General David Petraeus and his group during their surge, with the idea that they couldn't face the Iraqi population in a united front. They had to split it, so they had to create Sunni versus Shiite violence, and they pursued that with some extent. So this was Zarqawi and his group of Ansar, or really just Al-Qaeda, in Iraq. And so this has been going on for quite a while. We about a little bit less than a year ago, we had these papers from U.S. military intelligence that they saw that there was a definite potential to create a kind of a Sunni stan or Sunni entity there in the middle, the sort of the emptier areas of Syria and Iraq. And that then went on. As I said before, the beginning of the war in Syria, there never was a phase of peaceful protest in Syria. This is absolute falsehood. There had been violent, armed terrorists operating against Assad going back to the early 1980s, and that never stopped. It was continuous. So that when these people in March of 2011 or thereabouts came out into the streets protesting Assad, they were already armed. There were already third force people there who were making sure that these demonstrations turned violent.
Were those indigenous Syrians even in the 80s and 90s?
I think, some, but the point is, there never would have been a rebellion without foreign fighters deliberately brought in, paid for by Saudi Arabia, and then facilitated in by Turkey, by the Erdogan government of Turkey, right? And today it's lopsided, right? There's a substantial majority of these fighters are from outside of Syria, right? And I think it always seemed to me that the first point of pacification is get all foreign fighters out. Now, the ones invited by the government, that's different because that's allowable. But foreign fighters as a rebel force, this is not allowable. Now, the thing is, as time goes on, though, and especially lately, you can see that the U.S. is controlling less of these people, right? I think you could say as of about last summer, when the general commanding the U.S. Central Command, General Austin, when he came out there and said, we got, what did he say, 5-6 fighters trained in a $500 million program. To me, that said, at this point, the U.S. has very little influence over these terrorist rebels inside Syria. They are, after all, paid for by Saudi Arabia, either government or individuals, and certainly then promoted in by President Erdogan.
Do you think some of that was because of the heat that Clinton got and her involvement in that, and that they had to maybe take a step back?
Yeah, but look, you got to get the idea, right? In other words, I know everybody in the world loves to blame the U.S. for everything, and I think that is now obsolete. In other words, if you want to blame somebody for what's going on right now, you'd have to blame Saudi Arabia and the Turkish government. In other words, that's how it happened. And I think we can even show that other forces have not done what they needed to do. We have here a group of insubordinate and disgruntled officers around General David Petraeus, whose career was ended, Stanley McChrystal, who got fired because he was insulting the civilian leadership, and we've got some others. We had a guy called General John Allen, who last summer tried to set up the infamous no-fly zone safe haven for terrorists in northern Syria, and Obama repudiated him. And then finally, this Allen was forced out in September and October of last year. So I think right now the U.S. posture, the U.S. is not the main problem in this. As I say again, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and those international fighters. But now here's what it comes down to. If you look at your map, take a look at the Euphrates River and take a look at the town of Jarablus, sometimes written Jarabulus, but I think it's closer to Jarablus. And then go along that border area and get over to the town of Efren, north of Aleppo. And you've got a stretch there of about 100 kilometers or 60 miles, which is the gate, the logistical portal through which the weapons, the fuel, the money, the duped psychotic recruits are sent in to Syria, right, to ISIS, by forces in Turkey, because they could end this anytime they wanted to. It's clear that Erdogan regards ISIS as his puppet state or his irregular army, a secret army, if you want, that they're and they do what Erdogan wants. The U.S. is not in a position to tell Erdogan what to do. He is thought to be a high official of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he's also thought to be the practical day-to-day commander of ISIS. And he's got his son has been reportedly selling contraband oil out of the ISIS area on the world market. And then his daughter is reported to be the head of a hospital which treats primarily wounded jihadis, right? People who have been fighting in the civil war, and they're the only ones. That's on the Turkish side. But let's look at this Jarablus corridor, as I call it, Jarablus to Afrin. Again, 60 miles, 100 kilometers. If you want to end the Syrian civil war, which I think ought to be everybody's first goal, you need to interdict that corridor. In other words, you've got to close that gate using ground forces and air and whatever else you've got. You've got to cut that supply line. You've got to deprive ISIS of those logistics. And if you do that, ISIS will collapse within a month or two, with no question about it. And what you see is the U.S. has not done this, and that's a serious problem. I also have to point out Russia has not done this. They have not done it, and they could have, right? Because this is everybody knows this. This was even everybody on the inside. Last December, Susan Rice at the White House gave a briefing off the record, right? So we are assuming it's Susan Rice. And then the journalist came out and said one of the points mentioned was the need to cut that 100-kilometer stretch east of Jarablus on the Euphrates. Now, it's also true that the Turkish government has more or less said that they would regard cutting that corridor as casus belli, in particular, and there was a war. The if you look at the stretch, the border between Turkey and Syria, you will see that the Kurds, starting all the way over in the Far East, they have progressively taken over that border, right? The Kobane fighting some years ago, that was a big deal in that regard. And there were a couple of other places that were taken over last summer. So the ability of ISIS to get supplies now comes down to this 60-mile stretch. And many countries could close it. The U.S. could close it. Russia could close it. If Germany is really concerned about the influx of refugees, the Bundeswehr could be sent in there, and they could close it. And you'd have to say to Turkey, I'm very sorry, but your pro-terrorist activities are intolerable, and we won't allow it. And I think, therefore, if you're going to blame somebody, you want to blame one person, blame Erdogan. It's just simple, right? You look at the map, you look where the logistics go. Who could close it? Well, the easiest way to close it is for Turkey to do it. I think the U.S. is reluctant to do it because that would fracture the NATO alliance. I would urge them to proceed anyway. That's not an alliance worth having. If
we look at the really what matters here, it definitely seems like overall, like you mentioned, that ending the war in Syria is really the main issue. The best thing we can do for a refugee is end the war that's causing the refugees. We don't actually have to take in that many if we can end that war. But when we look at ISIS controlling a large part of the country, and when we look at the contemporary debate in the U.S., which is largely framed around, well, we can't end the war if Assad is still in power, and that's kind of the issue that they keep bringing up. How could we frame, like, we know that Assad is not a perfect person. It's a dictatorship. He has problems. But why is a stable Syria with Assad in power better than the alternative of overthrowing him or dividing the country or having ISIS be a long-term presence there?
I would say the first point of international affairs is to work with existing governments. That in today's world, any government is a potential ally against non-state actors. In other words, militias, terrorist organizations, things like ISIS or similar things, Boko Haram, it's a long list. Any government is likely, not always, but frequently, probably, going to be better than one of those terroristic, chaotic non-state actors. I visited
you would support
Libya
then civil
in
society
the summer
within...
of 2011 under the NATO bombing. I then visited Syria in November, just as the big phase of the civil war was starting up. I've also been, I've been in some other areas. But the problem with this situation is you've got to, rely on existing governments. Now, let's look at Assad. What we're seeing here is a clash that has gone back to the time of Nasser, and I myself have a large sympathy for President Nasser of Egypt, starting out in the late 50s, right? Anti-imperialism, kicking the British and the French out of the Suez Canal, using that money for national development, right? Modern Egypt is unthinkable without the Aswan High Dam. Populist measures, that is to say the bread subsidy, the cooking oil subsidy, the gasoline subsidy, these are important things, and they're eminently worthwhile. Now, of course, some doctrinaire market fetishist will come along and say, oh, no, this violates the rules of the British School of Ricardo or the Austrian School of von Hayek or some other crackpot economist who's nothing but an apologist for very greedy ruling class interests. They will object, but for the average person, you could go to Syria under Assad, again, November 2011, and the bread subsidy was still working. You had a beautiful loaf of bread for, almost nothing. You could cooking oil, olive oil, this was available at a very low price. There was a problem already with furnishing diesel oil or azut, as they called it, right, for internal heating and then some kinds of cooking. So with Gaddafi in Libya, the case is probably the clearest, right, that Libya had become the number one country in Africa on the United Nations Human Development Index, and that they were beating, all kinds of countries, better than Brazil, better than Ukraine at the time. And that was before the fighting. The other thing is Gaddafi had been the sponsor of the greatest civil engineering projects in recent world history. That is to say, the man-made pipeline where he took aquifers under the Sahara and using the largest steel tubes that were available anywhere in the world, and those were manufactured in Libya at their own factory, those steel tubes were used then to get the water to the coastal cities. And the fact that human life can go on at all in Libya right now has got to do with Gaddafi's great man-made river. So the point is, imperialism in general, the British, say, start with them, they don't want to be confronted by a modernizing, authoritarian, often military, secular regime. No, they don't want that. They want benighted, superstitious, backward, misogynistic obscurantists, right? That's what they like. So they like, the caliph al-Baghdadi, right? That's their kind of guy because he's so much easier to fight, right? His atrocities alienate the world. Nobody wants to work with him. He isolates himself. He defeats himself, in effect.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Looking at Libya, Iraq, Syria, they definitely seem to be major setbacks for civilization. Is it primarily geopolitical forces? Like, we know that Russia has a port in Syria and the U.S. and everyone's really vying for interests there. But how much do you think is really a drive within the politics of imperialist regimes to perpetuate war because that controls the dialogue, certain companies make a lot of money. Clinton favors better in a time of war, I think, than Sanders. If there was peace on Earth, then I think people would be more receptive to more progressive voices.
I didn't understand your point about Hillary Clinton.
So I'm trying to say that I'm trying to look at if we can see the wars as a problem for humanity, then The driving force behind war is the reason why Hillary Clinton supports war is because the people that she listens to, her advisors, are very interested in global domination, as it were? Or is it more of a fact that perpetual war supports a politics that is favorable for people like Clinton, who are more pro-war and more proponents of military action? So I'm just trying to think.
I think the first thing is, I wouldn't say war as the goal, but the destruction of these countries. In other words, the original idea of the Arab Spring, right, was to let's send out Julian Assange, right, with a limited hangout, fresh from CIA headquarters, and let's have that limited hangout, you know, attack Ben Ali of Tunisia and the rest of them, and the so-called the fake Arab Spring. The Arab Spring, a complete fake, completely designed by MI6, CIA, and so forth. But then the idea is a regime like Gaddafi can say no, and they did say no. You go to Egypt, Mubarak said no. They said, we want to have a U.S. base in Egypt. No. We want Egyptian troops in fighting in Iraq in the first and second Gulf Wars. The answer to that was no. We want you to have a military alliance with the Israelis. No. And so forth. Right. So these governments that can say no, they have to be fought. And again, the Muslim Brotherhood was invented by the British. This is British intelligence in Egypt in the late 1920s found that anti-imperialist, anti-British sentiment was growing in the Waft Party. The Waft Party was the main sort of bourgeois party at the time. And they found that this group was feeling nationalistic. So they said, we have to concoct something that's going to say no, that is not the way to go, that we want to be benighted and backward, and we've got to turn back the clock on the status of women and all sorts of other social reforms. In other words, the big threat in the 1920s was the successful reforms of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in Turkey, right? This is, to me, one of the great heroes of the 20th century. Obviously imperfect, but still a bringer of civilization, right? Every other country that lost World War I became fascist, but not Turkey under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. So if you look at the continuity, it's essentially Nasserism on the one side in any form you want, right? The Gaddafi is explicitly inspired by Nasser. I've talked to people over there about this. Similarly, the Assad family, Egypt, of course, the PLO, all of these have this original idea of Nasserism. And the only thing you can fight that with, as the imperialists figured out, is this benighted Muslim Brotherhood approach, which is essentially turn back the clock, get the women back into the harem, or keep them inside the house, or make them cover themselves and so forth. But the things that Atatürk had attacked. Now, there's also an instinctive hatred of independent third world countries. We've just had the Washington Post and the New York Times in two articles have found that the reason the U.S. went along with the bombing of Libya, this is now March 2011, was Mrs. Clinton. And notice, the U.S. was not, repeat, not the prime mover on that. That was Nicolas Sarkozy. And you have to know that there is a secret treaty. Since the British and the French are now so weak, they cannot act alone. They have a treaty which sets up a process by which they will act together. And they had signed a treaty in a specific subset of this treaty in late 2010, where the British and the French said, in effect, we're going to be attacking a country in North Africa, which is sparsely populated, a lot of desert, but a lot of oil. We're going to be attacking that country. So that's Libya. And that was called Operation Harmattan, Harmattan, one of the winds of the Mediterranean. So Bernard-Henri Lévy of France, the philodoxer, I guess we'd call him, he was out there in Benghazi telling stories about imminent massacres. He convinced Sarkozy that this was the case, and Sarkozy then convinced Mrs. Clinton. And then the British were also in on the game. So That's how that actually happened, right? And the Russians failed to veto. Like, well, the easiest thing in the world is to veto that. But that was, of course, Medvedev, whose faction still exists, right, and still does things. But in those days, it was the Medvedev faction that said, we're not going to veto it. We're going to go along with that. And Medvedev came under attack from the Russian ambassador in Libya, Chamov, who said that this was essentially an act of treason on the part of that president at that time. So today we have Putin, so we're better off. But you also have to, you know, you got to look at this with your eyes wide open. Finally, the thing that I think people have to understand, Hillary Clinton is a warmonger. She's a systematic, implacable, incorrigible warmonger. And one of the main reasons for this is, obviously, because she's in cahoots with these bankers and these strategists and so forth, right? All the imperialist think tanks that we have. She's all that. But here's the main thing. She's a feminist, and she feels that she's going to be mocked as a weak woman unless she's the biggest warmonger in the room. She's got to be the biggest warmonger in sight, because otherwise she's deathly afraid that somebody says, oh, you're soft, you're a sentimentalist, you're another one of these weak women. And her method of compensating for that is to be the warmonger. In other words, there's got to be no space to her right. She's got to be the extreme right wing on every warmonger meeting. And I think this is certainly one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton should never, never be allowed to be president. Because ultimately, she does this to avoid the perception of weakness. But if you understand how she's thinking, you can see that her behavior is the acme of weakness. In other words, that's the dictionary definition of weakness, is that you feel so impacted inside. You feel so weak inside that you've got to overcompensate for that with a bellicose and jingoistic demeanor on the outside. So she's not qualified. She's actually psychologically disqualified from being president.
So one of the last issues I want to talk about is international terrorism, and I have a specific question for you. From my point of view, like the issue with terrorism, we hear a lot about it on the news, and I realize that people want to know what's going on in the world and they want to be informed, but it seems to me that terrorism kills so few people that really the problem with terrorism is overreacting to it in a sense, that that's really what a terrorist tries to do, is to try to control or influence the politics in a way that benefits them. And I think we hear these crazy things about, we'll bomb entire countries. If there's a terrorist living near you, we'll bomb you. We'll upheave the whole entire world in order to reduce terrorism. But I don't know if this is a fair perspective, but it seems to me that really the main problem with terrorism is that we spend so much attention on it. Really, terrorists are really weak. They kill a few people a year. Like a bus rolls into the ditch, it kills more people than a terrorist. But we're not going to stop all buses. And of course, that's nothing to downplay the loss of lives and how no one wants to live in that kind of state of affairs. But it just seems that sometimes the best thing to do is to really get your own bearings and not play the game of the terrorists, and police actions, regular. If there's a specific issue, like in Syria, we want to settle the civil war, if that's a generator of peace. What do you think about that?
Well, again, on Syria, you've got to cut that Jarablus corridor, and that will have to be done with the violent means. In other words, I don't see how you could be reticent about bombing ISIS. I think ample military force could play a very useful role, but it's got to be the kind of force that brings things to an end. In other words, that makes resistance and attacks coming from this quarter cease. We got to look at what you're talking about over time, right? Say, if we're in the year 2000 or 2001, I think you could say, well, Al-Qaeda, what's Al-Qaeda? I have to also point out, I have never accepted the U.S. government version of September 11, 2001. I've written a book about this. I think it's the definitive treatment among the ones out so far, which is that this was done by a rogue or renegade faction, a parallel government or deep state inside the U.S. bureaucracy for the purpose of starting Samuel Huntington's Wars of Civilization, which it has more or less done. In other words, it shaped the entire outlook for a generation or more, almost now. So My standard take on al-Qaeda at the beginning, say, 2001, 2002, was, yes, there is al-Qaeda, but they do not have the means to direct these planes across, you know, vast stretches and blow up the Pentagon and hit the towers in New York and have them come down. All of this is so complicated, and so it requires so much preparation, including on the ground in a number of these cases, that al-Qaeda can't do that. What can al-Qaeda do? Al-Qaeda can blow up a supermarket. Al-Qaeda can blow up a bus. Al-Qaeda can kill people in an airport or a plane, things like this. But then you have to see over time this then changed, and within, say, 8, 9, 10 years after 9/11, you actually have an al-Qaeda and other similar organizations, competitors or, you know, collaborators, whatever they are, that can do more. In the sense, when I went to Syria in November of 2011, I was able, I hope people will go and look at this on tarpley.net, my website. It's an interview that I did from Damascus, Syria, in there's this famous chair where you sit, and then behind you there's a fountain and a large open square. This was Russia Today, and I told Russia Today that what was happening in Syria were death squads with significant foreign participation were attacking civilians, because I had been in Homs, right, the cradle of the revolution in Homs, and we'd gone to a hospital, and the hospital said that you know, the woman doctor that I talked to, woman doctor, right, that was on thanks to Assad. And she said she was going to go home, but she was always afraid for her life because there were snipers on rooftops, and they were killing people. They were killing mothers and children. They were killing mothers when they came to get their kids. They were, you know, killing people in the streets, and she had to get home. And she wanted more of the Syrian army to come in there. She said, "What's wrong with Assad? Why doesn't he send in the whole panoply of forces?" She said, "I want tanks here. I want actual Syrian army snipers up on the roofs of these houses and so forth." So what had happened was death squads, as I said to Russia Today, these death squads coming from abroad. I was not exactly sure from where, but turned out, you know, that at the beginning, a relatively limited phenomenon caused by death squads. Now, over this time, these groups have become more numerous, and they've become veterans. They've been through Libya, they've been through Syria, they've been through some stuff in Egypt. They're in the Egyptian Sinai right now. So they kill people. And I think right now you'd have to look at that threat differently. In other words, I think it's fairly clear that the fanatics and lunatics who make up the leadership of ISIS would certainly be glad to blow up the Vatican, as they've said, or make other attacks. So
you do think that I would take that seriously.
I don't think this is the time for something like unilateral disarmament in regard to these people, because the fact is they are now there. In other words, a lot of these people were shocked into militancy by 9/11, right, by this fantastic story that crazy old Osama bin Laden in his cave could actually do these things, right? The craziest story. In other words, if you believe that story, you're in la-la land, and then you can imagine that you jihadi, you're going to go out and do something similar. And a lot, you know, a whole generation has fallen for that, and probably the beginnings of another generation. So I would not minimize that. In other words, you can go back and reconstruct how this threat emerged, right, starting with 9/11, to be sure, and with the help of the CIA and the help of MI6. But the fact is, like Hitler, it's now there. So you can't ignore the existence of it just because you know the dirty ways in which it was created.
So, I mean, certainly, like, if you're saying then that the defeat of ISIS really has to happen. I mean, if it's the Syrian army that's primarily doing it, then I don't think you can realistically expect the West to help out in that effort, given that ISIS is fighting the Syrian regime, which is an enemy of the West, or of the,
I wouldn't be so sure of that. In other words, I wouldn't be so pessimistic. I had the experience last summer, autumn. The Tax Wall Street Party launched a campaign, Get Allen Out, Fire Allen. His title at that time was ISIS Czar. He was the top guy in the State Department working with Kerry on the coalition. So it meant that Allen became the advocate of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And he was constantly scheming to try to go around Obama. Because, look, here's the other thing. Obama is, you know, disappointing on some points, a disaster on other points. Here's the main thing, though. He's not the warmonger you think. He has repeatedly rejected plans to escalate the Syrian war. At one point, he said, people come to me with a bunch of half-baked mumbo-jumbo about what to do in Syria. In other words, create this no-fly zone and safe zone for terrorists. By the way, the no-fly zone and the safe zone for terrorists is exactly the area you'd have to block. In other words, it's right below the Jarablus corridor, right? It's right along that stretch of border. So the idea is you can't go there, so nobody can interfere with ISIS. But Obama has done that, and that quote about the half-baked mumbo jumbo, I think, is important. And he's been opposed by this clique of officers that nobody writes about, but it's fairly obvious: Petraeus, Allen, McChrystal, others. Breedlove, the NATO commander, at least until recently, was one of them also. So,
but are you suggesting that you could envision NATO sorties flying in support of the Syrian army against ISIS? Could that?
Well, you wouldn't have to call it in support of the Syrian army. Sure, absolutely. Why not? You know, Merkel is a fool. When I was in Germany last October, November, I gave a big speech in near Frankfurt, and said, look, if you want, you know, they're all so worried about these refugees, I think, with some reason. If you want to stop that, you have military forces. Why don't you close that Jarablus corridor? In other words, this whole thing is so vulnerable and so artificial. It depends so much on sanctuaries, in effect, right, on zones where they can run wild. Right now what you have is this. The Syrian army has the Russian Air Force. But then we have the Kurds, and we can't forget the Kurds. The YPG Kurds, which are the best Kurds, and including women, very gallant ladies. You've got the PKK Kurds, and then you've got this Talibani operation in northern Iraq. The northern Iraq Kurds, at least their leadership, I think, is frankly rotten. The PKK, somewhat better. The best of the YPG. So if you look at that stretch along the border, right? The only way that the YPG Kurds were able to take Kobane and cut one of the main roads in the area is thanks to the U.S. Air Force. And you've had, you know, the capture of Ramadi. They now seem to be, they're building up for an attack on Mosul. So I think, you know, you've got an established fact that there's a cooperation between the U.S. Air Force and Naval Air with the Kurds. So, somehow you bring this together. The other thing you've got to factor in, now this is coming from my friend Thierry Maison of the Voltaire Network, right? Le Réseau Voltaire. He's been in Damascus, Syria for the entire war. He's always talking about coordination behind the scenes between Putin and Obama. Most recently, that Obama and Putin have decided between them that Erdogan must go. That his activities, right, his, you know, betrayal of all sides, right, shooting down Russian planes, you know, insulting the U.S., you know, duplicity, supporting terrorism, enabling the logistics, right, that he has to go. And the crowning piece, I urge people to read Tarpley.net and listen to these broadcasts. The last time I had Maison on, he said that the intelligence world, sort of the good guys in the Middle East, is that Erdogan is the prime suspect in the Belgian bombing in particular and in the Paris bombing of last November. He wants to get a Kurdish state, which would be a puppet state of Turkey, Got it? So it would be taking the land which the YPG has liberated, or it's a complicated question, but which they've carved out of northern Turkey, but they've liberated it from ISIS in the most recent round of events, that project has been repeatedly blocked, and that when it is blocked, then Erdogan lashes out with bombs in Paris and bombs in Brussels. So that's Masson's account, and I think that compels quite a bit of attention. And again, this notion of a secret coordination between Obama and Putin, I think that's eminently plausible. And I know from here, the reason you'd want to do that is we have these lunatics, right? We have the Republican Party, who, if they found out you were coordinating with Assad, whatever else they had been saying about it, they could have been calling for that the day before. If they found out you were doing it, they'd try to impeach you. So that's one thing. And I think we don't really know that much about the anti-Putin opposition. I mean, we know some things, and they're bad, and they're there, and you know they may have ways of trying to threaten Putin over this issue of cooperating with the U.S.
Dr. Tarpley, we're running low on time.
Sure.
What final thoughts about our discussion today? Anything that you want to remind the audience of as they think about the world and what needs to be
sure.
done?
Sure. I would urge people in Canada to think about what you can do to raise this issue of fascism. And there was the ideal thing would be the U.S. ambassador in Ottawa is called in, and he's told the fascist Trump is unacceptable, and if that guy gets to power, we're going to abrogate whatever we can abrogate and stop cooperating in a whole number of ways, right? And then the Canada might have to think about their own border. It's not just, a wall along the Mexican border and the deportation of 12 million people that we have with Trump, but that, other countries may feel security threats. In other words, whatever you can do to raise this question of fascism in the context of Trump. And I think one of the main demands is that you can't treat Trump and his supporters as if they were other normal people, right? We just have a guy called Roger Stone. He's a provocateur. He's a political saboteur going back to Nixon, right? He started off with the Watergate scene, right? The committee to reelect the president in 1972. And this guy's now, he's saying, Trump has said, if he doesn't get the Republican nomination, there will be riots in Cleveland. And now this Roger Stone is saying there will be riots. There's going to be days of rage. And he also says we will have the hotel rooms, numbers, and hotels of the delegates, and we will send people there to harass them. And I think a very sensible commentator said the Republican Party ought to ban at least Roger Stone from the Republican convention. So you got to be aware of this. The other thing I think is, within the councils of NATO, the idea that the Syrian civil war could be ended, and that what Turkey in particular is doing, and I think Erdogan and his friend Davutoglu are quite isolated in this, I think. I don't see a lot of support elsewhere inside NATO for this, but that they have got to be called to account, that probably Putin and Obama are right, that the Erdogan government is simply outrageous, intolerable, unacceptable, and that, anybody, Turkish generals, any forces inside the country, should be invited to restore order inside Turkey. And other than that, I am hoping, this is my hope, is that if the Republican Party becomes extinct as a national party, or at least becomes a definitively minority party with 10 or 20% of the vote, they'd probably still have people in Congress and things like this, but they wouldn't dominate the Congress, they wouldn't dominate the presidency, they wouldn't dominate the Supreme Court. After that, the perspective is, in my view, that the Democratic Party is likely to split into two parts, Wall Street Democrats with Hillary Clinton, and then this other New Deal, pro-labor, progressive group, which it's somehow gravitated to Bernie Sanders because he's all there was. But there are even within the Democratic Party on that side today, there are people that are better than Bernie Sanders. The net effect of that, though, would be to shift the entire world political situation quite a few degrees to the left. In other words, I would encourage people to see the recent past, especially since 1968, which is when the New Deal coalition in the U.S. broke up over the Vietnam War, when Nixon won the election. And after that, we've had such horrible times. We've had declining standards of living. We've had union busting. We've had imperialist wars that were generally lost. We've had cultural barbarism, clearly declining standards of living. That a new era of human progress could open up if you had this sea change in the United States. In other words, that the American people, I would have to say, the American people have always been anti-fascist, in many ways the most anti-fascist, because we never had appeasement. We never had Chamberlain or Daladier appeasing Hitler. We never allied with Hitler. I'm afraid there was this Hitler-Stalin pact for a couple of years. There never was a Hitler-Roosevelt pact. And we've never had a fascist government. If you understand fascism in my terms, there's never been one. So that's good. But if Trump goes down, the Republican Party breaks up in that process, then we get essentially we get a debate between the Wall Street Democrats and the further left Democrats. This could be a great boon for the world. This could, again, move the entire political axis 5-10 degrees to the left, right, for the whole planet. And that's I think that would be a great achievement. So I urge, if you can visualize that process, find out ways you can join in. Let me recommend. I represent the Tax Wall Street Party. If you go to my website, tarpley.net, you can get a free subscription to really a daily briefing. It's called our daily briefing. It comes to you in the middle of the night, but it's essentially a strategic overview of the world and or, you know, topics of great immediate historical interest. Like this week, we went back and reviewed at least one of the American conventions that led to a party splitting up, right? The Democratic Party in 1860, which broke into two parts. That was tragic because that led to a civil war. But now, if the Republican Party breaks up, this will essentially mean that a whole nightmare world of ideology will have been lifted from the minds of many people, because it'll become discredited. It'll take months and months, but it'll die out. So come to tarpley.net, subscribe to the Tax Wall Street Party newsletter, a daily briefing. It's really more than a newsletter. It's like a publication in itself, day by day. If you want, very soon we'll be starting a service from here, which will be a one-hour daily television broadcast on, you know, news and cultural and political themes. Now, what we've seen, of course, is that some of these libertarian broadcasters, right, some of the loudmouthed ones, you're probably familiar with them, they're in tremendous crisis because they were all backing the Rand Paul dynasty of barbarians, right, people who wanted to lower the lower wages, you know, shred the social safety net and so on. Now that Rand Paul has gone, he may not even hang on to his Senate seat. These people have all shifted to Trump. So you've got this sort of very neat package of the most retrograde, most backward, most benighted people, all wrapped up with Trump. So if you defeat them, it's going to be good. But so in the meantime,
we're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Tarpley.
In the meantime, there's a great void in broadcasting, which we will attempt to fill. So keep in touch. Tarpley.net, and on Twitter, it's Webster Tarpley on Twitter and on Facebook.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks this week to special guest interviewer Colin Hamlin. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.